The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon, friends, and welcome back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We have a really interesting show for you today. I know you're going to want to stick around for all 3 hours. We're going to be talking about the big news in the media sphere. Actually, two big stories in the media sphere. Tucker Carlson leaving Fox News. Don Lemon leaving CNN. We'll also be talking about what's going on in Sudan and how that relates to what happened in Afghanistan. We'll be talking about another issue with a transgender using a shower that's reserved for underage girls at a high school. We will be talking about why you may not realize what Romeo and Juliet actually means. And that's going to be a really interesting segment in our third hour. But right now, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court and the decision that they made after punting a couple of times on the abortion pill. And we're going to be talking right now with Mary Fiorito. And Mary Fiorito is an attorney and the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at both the Ethics and Public Policy Center, easy for me to say, in Washington, and the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. Mary, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So this is an interim ruling. What took place on Friday was an interim ruling, and I think one of the more interesting aspects of this was the fact that they punted it twice. This was a request for a stay on an earlier decision, earlier interim decision at the appellate level, but the actual hearing on the merits hasn't actually taken place yet. This is probably going to be coming back to the Supreme Court sooner rather than later. And yet, rather than stay the earlier ruling and halt the sales of, and I can never get this name right, Mifepristone?
RU486 is how it was commonly known.
There you go.
And
yeah. Yeah. I mean, rather than halt the sales of this, they decided to let it go. Justice Alito wrote a dissent on this, essentially arguing that they should have stayed it just because he figured that the Biden administration was going to ignore whatever the Supreme Court said anyway. This is a really complex case. It has to do with regulatory law, has to do with regulatory process. Were you surprised that the Supreme Court ruled in this manner?
Well, you know, a little bit. Well, I'd like to just to reiterate your point, which is that the Supreme Court has not ruled on the substantive issues that were before
right.
it. As you point out, this is administrative law stuff and procedural stuff that, you know, kind of more of the policy wonk lawyers could probably get into in greater detail that would put everybody to sleep. So,
right.
what's interesting here, and I think also very troubling, if we could just sort of back up a little bit and look at the two rulings that sort of generated all of this media attention. And that was a ruling out of the Texas federal court from Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, and then a ruling out of Washington State from Judge Thomas Rice. And let me just get rid of the Washington one first. That particular ruling was given after 17 Democratic attorneys general from Democrat-led and run states asked for a federal opinion or ruling or permission or whatever word you want to use to be able to continue to use without any kind of regulation whatsoever the abortion pills in their particular state. The Texas ruling was a lawsuit filed in federal court by sort of an umbrella group of doctors. They call themselves the Association for Hippocratic Medicine, and they represent organizations like the American College of Pediatrics, and they also represent the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs, and individual emergency room doctors in their capacity as emergency room physicians. And what they pointed out was that the accelerated approval that RU486 or mifepristone was given back in the year 2000, it was put on a fast track approval process. Now that fast track approval process is only supposed to be used when we're talking about a medication that addresses serious or life threatening illnesses. That's what the law calls for, which is absolutely ludicrous if you compare that to pregnancy. Pregnancy
right.
is not a serious or life-threatening illness in 99% of cases. But that was the ruse that the Clinton administration used in those final months of power that they had to get RU-46 sort of pushed through without any of the normal testing. And part of what these doctors' associations and the emergency room physicians pointed out, that they are on the front lines in seeing women who are coming into their emergency rooms, because that's generally where women are presenting when they have an adverse infection to the abortion pill usage. And some of them are morally and ethically and medically opposed to abortion. They're finding themselves put in all sorts of different situations. You know, most often the baby has already died by the time the woman presents with hemorrhaging or what have you. But, you know, occasionally they find themselves in the position of having to perform abortions that they are ethically opposed to because the abortionist essentially didn't do their job right. And in 2016, some regulations that were, you know, I think everybody who is a common sense person could agree on, that you have to, at a minimum, have an in-person doctor's appointment, and that is to rule out things like an ectopic pregnancy. You know, unless you do an ultrasound exam, you don't know if that woman has an ectopic pregnancy or not. And that could put her in a legitimately life-threatening, you know, circumstances if she takes the abortion pill and she's got an ectopic pregnancy,
exactly.
If she has fibroid tumors, if she has a bleeding disorder. I mean, the list goes on and on, but also to verify the gestational age of the unborn child. And what happened is that the length of time to use the abortion pill was lengthened from 7 weeks gestation to 10 weeks gestation. But when you're handing out these pills, you know, through the mail without a doctor's visit, you know, that's a woman's best guess as to, you know, and usually the younger the woman, the less accurate she might be in charting her monthly menstrual cycle, and the less accurate she's going to be about that baby's gestational age. So then you could have a baby, you know, 11, 12, 13 weeks gestation, who, while, you know, is being aborted at home, you know, I'm sorry to have to be graphic here with the details, but a woman often passes the baby's remains while she's sitting on a toilet, and then you are coming face to face with a gestational sac with a little human being in it that is looking right back at you, and then you have to flush the toilet. So imagine the psychological trauma that something like that, you know, brings about. So this is what all of these myriad of ethical, moral, medical issues, this Association or Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, brought to the court. Judge Kaczmarek agreed, said they never, RU-46 or mifepristone never should have been put on this fast track approval process. And it was done so politically, and it's time to go back and let's put women's health first over politics.
And Mary, I mean, one of the issues that's coming up in this, I'm guessing, I haven't read the briefs myself, I've just read the news reports on this, but there is a large degree of I'm trying to think of what the correct word is, deference is the right word,
right,
to regulatory agencies in matters such as these. And I think that this is involving the Chevron doctrine as well as some other things. And that's actually been, and again, I'm sort of a nerd about this stuff, so I'm probably I'm probably going to fall asleep a little less quickly on this type of stuff than most of the listeners here. So just,
right.
You know, I won't go too far into that. But I mean, that's part of what's going on here as well. And it's been 20 years since this action was taken. And I imagine that that's some of what the court is looking at. But I do find it rather interesting that even with all of that going on, the Supreme Court was actually pretty careful not to get into this.
Right.
Simply to say we're just going to let the status quo ante proceed while this is all being hashed out at the appellate level. Under normal circumstances, if you're a conservative, you're probably saying, well, that's good. They're not being activist, right? I'm using scare quotes on this.
Right.
But in this case, I mean, I think that there's a clear violation here of a couple of the procedures, like you said. First off, it's on the basis, it was done on a basis that was used maybe more appropriately, even if the outcomes weren't very good in the COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, that's the type of thing that you want the FDA authority to have for that type of thing, not for something that is simply part of a matter of normal human biology. And and secondly, the courts have been paying a lot of attention in recent years, I would say probably more so than previously, to the Administrative Procedure Act and to other procedural requirements that you really do have to check off all the boxes. I'm not sure why they didn't decide to put a stay on it for that purpose or if they were just really concerned that the Biden administration might just ignore a ruling like that.
Right. And they very well may have done that. But I'm, you know, trying to see the silver lining in the cloud that was all of last week. what I always appreciate, you know, not only as a lawyer, but as a pro-life advocate, because we do have the facts and science on our side, I really appreciate opportunities for additional fact finding. And if that's what we're going to see then at the Fifth Circuit, that we're going to see actual experts, you know, called in, and we're actually going to see some kind of opportunity or at least an attempt to see how many women are coming in to emergency rooms. Because right now, all that you have to report are deaths from RU-46 from mifepristone. You don't have to report injuries that are so grave that they require a woman to present in the emergency room. Again, the hemorrhaging, the other things that can happen. So if we are able to get a better grasp on how this is harming women and how often, I think we will be much better off as a country. We'll have a much more solid foundation on which to stand if the pill is going to be regulated in some way. And I think, you know, if you look to Great Britain, you know, during COVID, they also did something that they called pills by post, which meant you could get the abortion pills through the mail. And they actually discontinued that program. There was a bit of outcry from their, you know, the abortion advocacy groups in their country. But not only were they finding that women were presenting in the emergency room, and remember, they're all socialized medicine, so they have a much better handle on numbers than we would here, where, you know, abortion reporting is largely it's an option of a state. They're not required legally to do it. But also of, I think there was one study that they did where 15% of the women who had used this pills by post program for the abortion pill had experienced some form of coercion in taking them. They were coerced into taking pills for an abortion they really didn't want. And then there were also a smaller percentage, but nevertheless, that there were the case of women who had these pills either slipped into food or slipped into a drink and wound up, you know, terminating a very much wanted child because the partner or the husband or what have you didn't want her to be pregnant. So, you know, whenever you are sending out these kind of things through the mail with little to no verification of the gestational age, the health of the woman, or even why she's requesting this abortion. I mean, you know, we know from sex trafficking survivors in the United States that they are forced by their traffickers to have abortion when they get abortions when they get pregnant. I, you know, in Illinois, where I live, where when Governor Pritzker repealed our parental notification of abortion act, we had survivors of trafficking, girls who had been trafficked through their teens, begging him not to repeal that law. I mean, one woman said, you know, had one of those abortions, her traffickers forced her into three separate abortions. She said, if one of those clinics had had to call my mom might have known what state I was in. And I mean, how you can, you know, listen to testimony like that and then cavalierly repeal a law that would require abortionists just to tell, not to get permission, just to tell a girl's parents that she's having an abortion, it just defies logic and common sense. So, again, that's sort of a long way of explaining. I really do think that a longer fact-finding process in which these kind of details and information about coercion, about dangers, are going to be brought to the forefront, and hopefully the American public will hear about it, then I think we have, then we're standing a really firm foundation if something more permanent is done.
We're speaking with Mary Fiorito of the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at Ethics and Public Policy Center, as well as at the University of Notre Dame. Taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Let's go to Larry on line one. Larry, welcome to the conversation.
Well, I have a couple of different angles to look at this from. Number one, I was conceived out of wedlock. My biological mother chose to give birth to me rather than have an abortion. The woman who adopted me, my adopted parents, were both very open about the situation. And the reason they could not have children of their own was because my mother had experienced an ectopic pregnancy. Yeah. And if she had not known that that was happening, if she hadn't had proper medical care, that could have killed her.
Well, yeah, exactly, Larry. And thank you very much for your call and for sharing that. I mean, this is part of what Mary Fiorito is talking about, is ensuring that people get the proper care. I mean, even if we disagree on the pill itself, and we're going to get to that because I want to talk about possible outcomes from the Fifth Circuit and then following on with the Supreme Court. I mean, the fact that they're dispensing this by mail to women who may not have even gone to a doctor yet is really rather astounding. And it's a point you made earlier, and Larry's story is a great example of why you can't do that. I mean, that is potentially causing a death. And
Larry, thank you for sharing that story, Larry, because I think all of us know someone who's here because their mother made a choice for life and sometimes made an adoption plan after that. And I didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to just point out, if I could explain, if listeners might not have an understanding of what an ectopic pregnancy is. So an ectopic pregnancy is when the unborn child doesn't attach inside the uterus after he or she is conceived. So implantation doesn't occur in the uterus, which is where a pregnancy needs to occur, right? And so it will happen, it will attach to some other part of the body. It's almost always the fallopian tubes, although you have the very rare case. There was a case in Africa, I think it was, where the unborn child attached to the mother's liver, and there was enough of a blood supply that the child was able to actually grow and was born, you know, a healthy child was born alive. Those are extremely rare situations, but almost always they attach inside the fallopian tubes. And in 90% of ectopic pregnancies, because the baby can't grow and isn't getting the proper nutrients, the baby will actually die by the time that ectopic pregnancy is discovered. And so there's no ethical or moral issue in either removing the fallopian tube or to use a chemical drug, sometimes methotrexate is used, in order to expel the child from the fallopian tube where it's attached. So Catholic hospitals treat women with ectopic pregnancies every day. It is not an abortion. And even until very recently, Planned Parenthood had that very statement on its website. Abortion clinics do not treat ectopic pregnancies because an ectopic pregnancy is not an abortion. And you know, you can go to any hospital. Usually it's treated in the hospital emergency room, and Catholic hospitals treat ectopic pregnancies just like every other hospital does. So there has been some effort, and you've probably noticed this, because I know Hot Air is always on top of these kinds of news stories, that that there has been a great effort on the part of abortion advocates to conflate having an elective abortion, surgical or chemical, and having treatment for a miscarriage or treatment for an ectopic pregnancy. They are not the same things.
Indeed. Indeed, they are not. And I thank you very much for the kind words, by the way, Mary. And yes. To get back to this case, you know, there's three different outcomes that could come out of the Fifth Circuit. One is that they stop the RU486 regimen altogether on the basis of an incorrect approval procedure in 2000 I believe it was 2000 when this took place.
Yeah, it was 2000. Yep.
2000, yes.
Just before President Bush took office, yeah.
Right. The second option is that they stop dispensing by mail and just require that it only be dispensed by doctors in conjunction with some sort of, you know, medical assessment. And the third is that they just leave it as it currently is, status quo prior to this lawsuit.
Right.
Knowing the way that courts work, I suspect that you're not going to get option one under any circumstances. There is at least a decent chance, though, I think, that they will stop the dispense by mail part of this.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. But other countries like Great Britain have actually, you know, done the responsible thing and stopped that. And, you know, for 16 years, from 2000 to 2016, everybody lived. And in fact, the government defended I call them kind of bumper rails that were around the use of the abortion pill, that it could only be used up until 7 weeks, that it required an in-person doctor visit, not only before, but also afterwards, to make sure that the woman was, you know, still healthy and was healing properly. You know, it required reporting of any adverse health impact upon the woman and not just death. And so now, since 2016, we don't even know how many women this has been harming because no one's required to report it anymore. All we know about is abortion pill deaths.
So First off, I just want to double check. Do you see any other potential outcomes other than the three that that I just laid out?
I mean, not off the top of my head, I don't, because but it's really hard to speculate right now with the states being divided, with the Biden administration doing kind of administrative end runs around what, you know, even different pro-life states have, you know, legislated for the people in their own states. So it's hard to tell with this administration because, you know, as Secretary Becerra said, you know, nothing's off the table. We will do what we have to do in order to get these abortion bills into women's hands. So I'm afraid to say, well, of course, no administration would ever do X when they seem very willing to do what, I mean, they have made it perfectly clear that getting these abortion pills, this is one of their priorities in this administration. And, you know, process and law be darned. If it's going to mean getting more abortion pills out there, they're going to do it. And then just sort of let the whole legal process play out. And then that, as they well know, that takes more time.
We are speaking with Mary Fiorito. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149. We're going to have one more in here quickly. Mary from San Francisco, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. I think that there should be a law that they should have this medicine only ordered by a doctor, but not for these people. Women coming in having abortions, they need to have every single one of them have an ultrasound to see how far along they are. I was 4 months pregnant, and I went into my doctor because I had a miscarriages before this, and I thought I was having another one. And I went in there, and the doctor wasn't my regular doctor, took the ultrasound and said, oh, I can't find the heartbeat. Get dressed and come in my office. And I said, well, can I see the baby on the screen? And they said, no, it's too small. Come in my office. They were sending me down to an abortion clinic to have a DNC when I said, no, I'm not going down there because I don't want to sit next to a woman who has a 3 months pregnant with a heartbeat, and I'm sitting here with no heartbeat, and I have a baby that's dead. Well, she said, no, that's what you have to do. Long story longer, I never went to the abortion clinic. I went back to my doctor that evening because they gave me some kind of a medicine to make me have contractions to have that baby when I have to have the DNC. But as a nurse, I just started hemorrhaging, and I had to go into the ER, and I saw the baby. They didn't do the DNC because I had such a contraction. And if I went home listening to, oh, you're going to be okay, whatever, I would have hemorrhaged out. So all women out there who are pregnant, please get medical help. How big or how far along your child is. Because if you have a DNC, if you have an abortion, if you have a miscarriage, you've lost your baby. End of story. I have two healthy boys now, but I had three miscarriages in the past. And you know, no matter what they do, they're still going to lose that baby. I wonder all this time. I think maybe God said he wasn't going to give me five children because I'm struggling enough to try to raise the two. But they're two young men now, and they're all fine. So,
well, God bless you, Mary. Thank you so much for your story. Thank you so much for your call. Mary Fiorito from the Ethics and Public Policy Center in the University of Notre Dame. Let's go ahead and give us a quick wrap up on where you think that this is going to be going.
Well, you know, if I could just quickly answer one of the things that Mary said,
absolutely,
because I think it's important. You know, she did miscarry a baby, you know, at 4 months. That's a, you know, obviously a very traumatic thing. But most Catholic hospitals, in fact, I don't know any who don't, but I don't want to be sweeping because I'm not sure. But usually most Catholic dioceses, the cemeteries, will bury the remains of miscarried and stillborn children for free. I know we do that in Chicago. So you can ask if you are miscarrying for the remains of that child. And then it can be buried. There's special little parts of the cemetery that are for babies who are miscarried and stillborn. And so I would just recommend that to anyone who's been in that situation. It really does help to bring about closure. And of course, it shows the respect, Ed, that we have for the human body as Catholics. So it is, you know, the unborn child is not medical waste that we throw away. So I just wanted to make that point because it's,
absolutely,
you know, it's very important for women's healings. So at any rate, where we're going to go with this, I, you know, watch for a lot of stories in the news about, you know, these abortion pills saving people's lives, without, and very little attention being drawn to, the dangers of taking this abortion pill without having an ultrasound first, without seeing a doctor, without verifying the gestational age of your child. And again, I think people need to be very, very sensitive to this pill being used in coercive fashions and in criminal ways as well, when women are being sex trafficked or young girls are being sex trafficked. I mean, to allow these to be sent through the mail, that is a sex trafficker's dream come true, because he doesn't even have to show up at a clinic with the girls that he's trafficking.
Mary Fiorito, thank you so much for being with us. You can be sure to follow her at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And also, she's at the at University of Notre Dame. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
This hour is sponsored by Creative Planning. How is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More info, including disclosures at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
All the news and issues
now
that are happening now.
One place.
The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Now.
It's 32 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. We've had an awful lot of stories that have to do with accommodations being made for transgender individuals in both adult and in minors, the context of minors. And the latter especially have been very, very frustrating, because these are issues in schools especially where parents expect their children, especially the girls, to be safe. And in fact, Title IX is designed, it's written to protect female minors and female adults, girls and women. And there are specific definitions for that in federal law. And yet we see, especially of late, where we see these incidents where schools are, rather than protecting women and girls in educational contexts, in both sports and in just general privacy, where they're failing to enforce this, mostly because of the pressure from transgender activists to treat biological males as females and biological females as males. And there is a particularly disturbing incident or accusation from Wisconsin, from the Sun Prairie Area School District, that popped up last week. And we're going to discuss that particular incident with Dan Lennington. He serves as deputy counsel for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which raised this incident in the first place. He focuses on the Equality Under the Law Project. And he previously served as the Assistant Deputy Attorney General and Deputy Solicitor General at the Wisconsin Department of Justice, where he argued constitutional law cases before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the Seventh Circuit, and state and federal courts around the state. Dan, first off, welcome to the show. Great to have you here with us. And I'm hoping that you can explain what happened at this presumably high school in the Sun Prairie School District.
Yes, thanks for having me, Ed. This is a troubling incident that happened on March 3rd this year. This is a public high school in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. It's a suburban high school right outside of Madison, Wisconsin. And it's a very fast-growing area and a large high school. And these four freshman girls had a physical education class as part of their first hour instruction, and they happen to be in a swim unit. There's a swimming pool in the school, and after the swimming class, the four girls entered the locker room, which was assigned to girls, the girls' locker room. And like most people who swim in public pools with chlorine, they wanted to rinse off, and so they went into the shower to rinse off, all four of them. And as they were in there rinsing off in their bathing suits, a male who is 18 years old approached them and completely disrobed, became fully naked, and said, quote, "I'm trans, by the way," and exposed his male genitalia to them and proceeded to shower right next to them. And the girls, understandably very flustered, finished up and left in a hurry, and did not want to report it immediately. This was a Friday, but they did tell a sophomore friend who told them the right thing to do was that they had to report this. This was an issue of sexual harassment, and this was a dangerous issue that an adult male exposed his genitalia to them in the girls' locker room. And so eventually the next week, starting on Monday, the administration became aware of this incident of sexual harassment, but did nothing. They did nothing to offer supportive services to the girls, to offer them the chance to file a Title IX complaint. They didn't take any steps. They didn't even call the parents. And once the parents found out about this on March 16th, they made calls and emails, and the principal responded by apologizing, but promising, we have a policy that addresses this situation, but the principal could not identify what the policy is or was. And this went on back and forth for weeks until the school finally agreed to sit down and have a face-to-face meeting with the parents. And at that time, they apologized, said it should not have happened, but they couldn't identify what the policy was or what the rule was. What has happened with the Biden administration, unfortunately, is that it has watered down Title IX and injected confusion into Title IX by using this phrase gender identity. And so schools now, they really can't have a policy. They feel like they can't have a policy that excludes everyone from a girls' locker room except for biological females, because they feel like they're going to be, they could be canceled on the one hand. And right. On the other hand, the girls can't feel safe and free from sexual harassment as they should be.
And Dan, I mean, one of the reasons why we have a boys' locker room and a girls' locker room is to prevent this type of thing from taking place in the first place, right? I mean, it used to be a recognition that there are biological differences between girls and boys, and there is a modesty/privacy interest for both boys and girls to not have that sort of exposure going on, primarily for girls, I would argue, but especially because of the risk of sexual assault and that sort of thing that take place. When you have an adult male, and an 18-year-old is an adult male, even if he's still attending high school, he's still an adult male, exposes himself to a minor female, that's usually treated as a sex crime. And especially even with the, oh, hey, by the way, I'm trans, which is what this young man supposedly said while he was disrobing. That to me, to not treat it at least initially as a potential sex crime is mystifying to me. If that had happened on the street, police would be called. If that had happened in a classroom, police should have been called. The fact that it happened in a locker room really shouldn't change that paradigm, right?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things going on here. As anybody knows who has worked with children in the past as part of their job, they know what it means to be a mandatory reporter.
Exactly.
If you could be a doctor or a nurse or some sort of healthcare worker, or work for a daycare, you're a mandatory reporter, meaning that if you have a reasonable suspicion that some sort of abuse is going on, you have to report it to the authorities. And abuse is defined as really any sex crime would be included. And in Wisconsin, we do have a law, as most states do, that when a adult exposes his genitalia to a minor for the purposes of sexual gratification, that is a felony in our state. It is in, I would guess, in most states. And that if you were a mandatory reporter, you were an administrator and you've been trained and frankly scared to death of not reporting something, you would probably pick up the phone and make a report. Now, this is over and above Title IX obligations,
right,
obviously.
Right.
Title IX obligations require that, offering services and reaching out to the girls and offering them the chance to file a complaint and having the Title IX officer and having a prominently displayed policy and all that sort of stuff. I mean, anybody who's worked in a job knows what it is like to get sexual harassment training. You know, we've all been through sexual harassment training and sat through webinars and things. And so it appears that there's just been a complete breakdown of that system in this school, and that the people there were not trained, or if they were trained, they were afraid to report this because they didn't want to, you know, upset the woke mob by punishing someone who claims to be trans, and that perhaps that would that ideological sin would be greater than the sin of not protecting the children, which
right.
we know is backwards.
Well, right? I want to talk about a couple different things. We're talking with Dan Lennington, who's deputy counsel for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, WILL, and it's not just in this context about exposing oneself for the purposes of sexual gratification. I mean, you can read every single day or nearly every single day where there is some teacher who has taken, nude selfies and sent them to a student, both male and female. In fact, I see a lot more in this case with female teachers engaging with underage students in that matter. And that's just a picture. That's not in person, although sometimes it's grooming behavior, so sometimes it progresses into an in-person encounter. But that's illegal in and of itself. And to me, I am really stunned. I guess I'm not surprised, but I am stunned that this wasn't addressed as in that context, especially given that the male in this case was an actual of-age adult.
Well, when the parents found out about this, one parent did report it to the school resource officer, which is a member of the police department. So it has been reported at least by a parent to the law enforcement. We don't know if the school has reported it to law enforcement. They have not told us that they've done that. They've hidden behind this idea of, student privacy, and therefore they can't talk about anything except assuring the public
right.
that these allegations are completely false. And that everything is under control. That's really the.
Well, yeah, I mean that was the. Dan, that was the. Because I read this in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which is the main newspaper there in that in Milwaukee area. This was in Madison where this took place, or near Madison, but Milwaukee is really the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is really the state's biggest newspaper, I believe, and they were saying that. The school district is saying that recent reports about the event are, quote, ill-informed, inaccurate, and incomplete. And I'm wondering what was incomplete about, is there some sort of context in which an 18-year-old exposing himself to four 14-year-old girls, is there some completing event that would make that somehow okay? Because I just found the incomplete part of this rather intriguing. What have you heard along those lines? Have you heard anything the school district about how this is supposedly incomplete?
No, they haven't told us. They haven't told us what's wrong with the story. I mean, our letter is based on eyewitness accounts, and that's
right.
very important. And parents who were on phone calls, and we have emails from the school district, which apologizes for this event and says, it should not have happened, and it will not happen again. If that's all true, we're wondering, what is the fact that they're disputing is? I think what they're disputing is my claim in the letter that they broke the law. That's probably what they're disputing. But they're not disputing really any of the facts of this. But, this is just – it's sad. Parents – not all parents have the chance to send their kids to private schools or parochial schools. And we pay a lot in taxes, and these taxes go to support these schools. And if you're a parent who wants to or has to send your kid to public school, you should at least have the belief that they are going to be safe while they're there. I mean, is that sort of the baseline thing? And that's really what's sad here. And, what I would encourage parents to do who have children in public schools is to make sure that they know what the school's policy is. Ask their school, are biological males allowed to be in female locker rooms? And if the answer is anything other than no, you have some questions that you should be asking to your school board, and you should have a reason to get involved in your school board elections. So it is a matter of safety. It's a matter of public safety, and especially for vulnerable young girls.
We're speaking again with Dan Lennington and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Let's go ahead and take a break right now. And when we come back, we'll take your calls and we'll also talk about Title IX and how Title IX actually plays into this and why parents should be very well versed on Title IX requirements, as Dan just started to get into, how you can prepare yourself to make sure that you're well informed about what the right, what your rights are and what the responsibilities of the school are. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Your news, the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Your news now.
Hey, if you're in the market for health insurance, well, our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is here to help you and your family find the most cost-effective health plan. Learn more at relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy, live, coming up. You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 49 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. We are speaking with Dan Lennington, Deputy Counsel for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. That's at will-law.org, I believe. Is that right, Dan?
Yes, will-law.org.
Will-law.org. And so you can go check that out there. You can check out the other work that they do there. Before we get back, Dan, to what the requirements are, what the responsibilities are under Title IX, I do want to take a quick call from Edith in Indiana. She's got a good question. Edith, welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. Yes, I was wondering if the schools are having a problem with this. They shouldn't, you know, allow men and women in the same
changing facility, that type of thing, sure, yeah.
Yes, yeah. But why don't they just keep the man's room and then the woman's room and then just make an extra room for the trans people? Because they're going to do that no matter what anybody says anyway.
Well, that's actually a pretty good question, Edith. Thank you very much for calling in. Dan, that's a question that I have about competition as well, right? I mean, if the solution, at least to competition, is if you want to recognize transgender athletes, then create a third category, a voluntary third category for transgender athletes to compete. So you don't have men competing against women and women competing against men. You have people who are voluntarily associating in a separate category for that thing. I mean, there's obviously going to be some fixed cost to creating a transgender changing room and transgender showers, but wouldn't that satisfy the Title IX issue and allow for schools to be as I don't know what the correct word would be here, as hip as possible without actually putting girls and boys in danger?
Well, just to let you know what's going on at this school, they do have gender-neutral locker rooms.
Oh, they do?
And, yeah, so there's no excuse. I mean, this is a giant high school. It was built in the last 10 years. There's another giant high school that was built last year in the same school district. They specifically designed these to provide gender-neutral areas for the trans students, the numbers of which are growing at an exponential rate. So they do have special places. So what was going on here, we can all speculate, but it was perhaps something other than just a desire to change or take a shower. Something right. else was going on here. So I'm personally not an advocate for us to say that we're just going to have three categories in all of our sports, because then we're going to, you know, someday have four categories and then five categories. And then what exactly is going on in the transgender restroom, because, or the locker room, because you'll have biological boys and biological girls still together, and they will right. be intentionally mixed at that point. And, I wouldn't think that would not be satisfactory resolution to anything. So what you'd have to have is several permutations of locker rooms that would be unworkable so that, that people of different identities can stay together. But fortunately, we know that we have all been created as male and female, and that seems to be pretty easy to solve and a pretty easy thing that we can deal with, and we've been dealing with it for centuries, that we can have separate spaces for males and females to, you know, preserve our modesty and keep everyone safe. That seems to be the simplest rule. Seems to be the best rule, I would say, in this situation.
Well, I would definitely agree with you, Dad, but it's still a good question that Edith asked. And, you know, I think it's a fair question to ask, in fairness, to allow for that discussion to take place. But, I agree with you. We've been doing this for millennia as human beings, and we have always understood that there was safety and modesty issues in play when you're dealing with this. And that's what Title IX actually exists for. I mean, this is a great transition back to Title IX. Title IX was created 50 years ago, I think a little over 50 years ago, maybe 52 years ago, for the specific purpose of protecting women and girls in educational settings, including in competition settings, so that they could have the same opportunities as men and boys in education and athletic competition, and so that they were not going to be crowded out of this, because that had been the case before, where you had all the money going into, say, you know, the men's football team at a college and nothing for, you know, the women's volleyball team and that sort of thing. Title IX exists to separate and then ensure equality or in investment in those things. So how in the world does the school not have a responsibility to protect these girls under Title IX as well as other laws? What are their specific responsibilities? What should parents know when they don't meet those responsibilities?
So under Title IX, it prohibits discrimination based on sex in education. And that has a lot of layers to it. And one of the layers would be to be free from sexual harassment, sexually hostile environments. There's also the sports angle, as you mentioned, where there must be equality in funding that does allow opportunities for girls to participate in sports, because if you talk to a lot of, you know, athletes, myself included, when you leave high school and you're no longer an athlete and you look back at that time, you can definitely see how sports was part of your education. Sports teaches a lot of important virtues to students, and that's why we want to have equal access to males and females, so that they can get the educational benefit of sports. It's not just fun, but it's teaching you important lessons. So, a school that hears a reasonable accusation of sexual harassment under Title IX, they're the ones that have a number of duties on them. They have a duty to reach out to the victims, to offer supportive services to the victims, to offer the victim the opportunity to file a Title IX complaint. Overall, the victims have the right to have their disclosure to be treated seriously and to be treated with fairness and respect and be given due process. They have a right to be informed about what are the policies of the school. The school has a duty to prominently display its policies. The school has a duty to have a Title IX coordinator and to train their staff and to retrain their staff. There's a right to confidentiality. There's a right to an option to make a report to law enforcement. There are tons. If you would like to know more about these sorts of things, what you can Google is Title IX Know Your Rights. If you type in Title IX, Know Your Rights, one of the first pages that will come up, and this, Ed, you'll love this, is from the Department of Education, and it's a very nice summary of your Title IX rights. Title Rights, Know Your Rights. But at the very top of it, it says something important. It says, let me read it here. It says, rescinded. This document has been formally rescinded by the department and remains available on the web for historical purposes only. What does that mean? It means the Trump administration created this very nice Know Your Rights handout, talks about schools, responsibilities, and your rights, but the Biden administration revoked it. So you can know your rights, which are very clearly laid out on the Department of Education's website. But you can also see at the top in bold red letters that the Biden administration doesn't agree with this anymore.
Well, it hasn't changed.
In a nutshell, that is where we are right now.
But the rights haven't changed, right? Just very briefly, the rights haven't changed, correct?
Correct. They have not changed at all. But the Biden administration wants to take it in a new direction, yes.
They want to take it in a new direction, and we know what the direction that they want to take it in. And so that's why it's even more important that you know your rights. And you can find out more about this over at will-law.org. Dan Lennington serves as deputy counsel for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. That's will-law.org. So be sure to check that out there. Dan, thank you very much for being with us. Coming up next, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. Please stand by. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back. Back.